Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here. Another Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock with Tom Hsu running the board.
Oh, so good to
be functional board.
I love being down here in the actual springtime. Not the winter so much, but the spring, love it.
You know, this is why we live here, right?
Darn right.
I want to start out the show today with a quote, and I think it's a quote, Tom, you're going to appreciate, and it kind of rolls into my next story. So I'm going to go ahead and play this right now.
I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what I'm with isn't it, and what's it seems weird and scary to me. It'll happen to you.
And I find this inspirational quote when I see people play video games. Now, you're a video gamer.
I am.
I'm not. It scares me. It frightens me, video games.
You know what scares and frightens me? Twitter. Instagram,
no.
Too much Facebook. I mean, I'm part of the whole Facebook thing. I can deal with that, but tweeting and Instagramming and all that stuff, I just don't want any part of it.
I do the Facebook. The Twitter, I'm not so great at, but if you want to follow TC Media Now on Twitter, by all means, when I do tweet, it's great. But here's why I bring this up, because there's a story that came out after last show, like within hours, and we've discussed this before. After 31 years, an Atari ET game was pulled out of a muck of an old New Mexico landfill. The rumor, the legend was that these ET games, they couldn't sell them because they were so horrible. It was really
They were bad.
And this is from CNET. We found something, said Zach Penn, and the crowd cheered. Penn, the director of films like X-Men 2, is making a film about the hunt for thousands or even millions of Atari ET game cartridges. The company disappeared 31 years ago. No one has known for sure where they went until now. Now we know. For anybody who doubted, Penn continued, there's a whole heck of a lot of games down here. We just saw them. Now the picture is they're pulling out this what looks like a perfectly good ET game out of a landfill. And the point of this whole thing is that really horrible game, I could play that. It's the games now that
You know what? I'm gonna challenge you on that, because you couldn't even play that back when it came out. That game was so broken and just...
Oh, no, it wasn't enjoyable to play, could play it.
No, you couldn't even play it. It didn't work.
The story of the financial critical disaster of Atari's ET game is well known. Rushed to market in just 6 weeks to try to leverage the incredible success of Steven Spielberg's hit 1983 movie, the game was a monumental disaster.
Now, was it in a landfill? I thought it was just buried in the desert, like this random strange section out in Death Valley.
According to me, I'm looking at the picture here, and it looks like Tatooine, looks like a desert here with just... And again, there's guys in construction vests here pulling out games, and the crowd's cheering. It's
that's kind of strange to go watch that happen.
This landfill has been closed since 1986, and the city is happy that the film crew came along, because now someone is actually paying to excavate this garbage. So the film crew is paying to relieve the city of this this toxic waste. And I'm wondering if these games then are able to play them. I'm sure that'll be the next part of the movie.
I bet somewhere in the middle of the pile is a completely untouched by anything stack of Atari games. We're really letting our nerd colors fly this morning.
Yes, we're going to go from high nerd to some actually pretty serious topics today. I do want to talk about one other thing before we go to break, though. Bob Ryan, former KSTP TV news anchor, passed away this week. At age 9, Bob Ryan, this is from Star Tribune, Bob Ryan had decided to become a broadcaster, often using a wooden stick as a microphone to make believe he was a radio announcer. And at 15, he rode the subway to 1939 World's Fair in New York, where he saw an invention called television. Ryan of Minneapolis died Monday of congestive heart failure of age 89. He was KSTP's pioneer anchor from the 50s to the 70s. And from Stanley Hubbard here, he was a great communicator, a great broadcaster, a real pioneer in television news, said Stanley S. Hubbard. Bob was doing television news at Channel 5 when almost no stations in the country were doing television news. Ryan was one of Midwest's most widely recognized and respected broadcasters, said Steve Raymer of the Pathak Museum of Broadcasting, which inducted Ryan into its Broadcasting Hall of Fame in 2001. I think he was a charter member of the Pathak Museum of Broadcasting. A long time. He was the original anchor of the Minnesota News Network, where that was a band of small stations across town that provided news and farm and weather reports too. And our friend Stan worked there for a period of time.
So, during this week on the All Request show, Stan had a tribute to him. Basically, he was his mentor when he first got in there. Very experienced and very willing to help gentlemen.
I had the privilege of actually sitting next to him at dinner one night at a Pavic Museum event, and just a great person. And that voice, you know, people that from that generation of broadcasting, and they were true pioneers. They have that just a booming voice. So when they talk to you and say "pass the salt," it sounds
like a broadcaster.
That's right,
telling you pass the salt.
That's right, and it's their natural voice too. I mean, this is a guy at age 9; he was working that voice for a long time. A great guy.
Well, that's what people wanted, especially back then. Right now, if you try and speak with that kind of a voice, you're not going to get as good a reception.
Well, I'm going to work on that voice. I think I'm going to work on that.
I believe.
But again, you know, sympathies to the Bryan family, and I'm very glad that I was able to meet Bob the last couple of years through the Pavic Museum. And you can go to Pavic Museum, museumofbroadcasting.org. You can see some information on Bob, even some video. I want to have a serious discussion today, and I brought in Nick Coleman. He is the executive director of the uptake.org. He's a former journalist with Minneapolis Star Tribune and the St. Paul Pioneer Press. He's got a lot of opinions, so we're going to have a pretty lengthy and interesting discussion today on Nick was actually someone that uncovered some, we'll call it some offhand comments by a sports owner in this town 35 years ago. And we're going to discuss that kind of comparison to the Sterling thing, which I didn't know what Sterling was until this weekend. I know more about Sterling than I ever wanted to know. And also, Nick has some comments just on media and the newspaper, things we talk about every week. So we will come back with Nick Coleman here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with my special guest today, Nick Coleman of the Uptake, correct?
It's really difficult to figure out what I am off. Hey, was that Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass?
Close. This is from the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. It's KG. Not on your iPod?
Okay. I missed that one.
Uptake and also the State I'm In blog and a former journalist with the Star Tribune, St. Paul Pioneer Press.
I prefer to just say St. Paul Pioneer Press.
Okay. We won't discuss that. You know, actually, you know, that was one of my topics I wanted to talk with you about today. Yeah. Also, was what do you think about the new owners of our local paper? But let's pause on that a second.
Oh, I could probably give you a few thoughts.
You know, I know you have a few thoughts on a few topics. That's why I thought this might be a fun half hour radio here. But I've been having you on the show for a while, and what really sparked my interest and brought you here today was I'm reading the city pages as I do, and this headline here caught my interest. It says the Twins once had a racist owner too, and his statue stands outside Target Field. So there's this whole Sterling thing kind of came up last week, and I didn't know who this guy was until this story came up. I don't really follow the NBA, but now I know all about this guy Sterling and. A NAACP award, lifetime award winner, which he has some opinions. Which when you get a girlfriend mad, be careful what you say to her on the phone is the moral of the story.
Yes, I think you know my mama taught me to be careful what I ever say, any place, any time. But I guess that's old fashioned.
It must be a generational divide that now we have to assume that everything we say, on air, off air, hot mic. Cold mic. Someone's recording someone all the time now.
Right, but Sterling apparently, I mean, he acts outraged that somebody revealed him, unmasked him as the bigot that he is, and what a weird situation since he's in a league with so many African-American athletes and apparently just doesn't really like them all that much.
Well, he likes winning championships or winning games with them. That's just you know that.
That just makes him a money grubber, in my estimation. And you know he's probably going to fight back against this ban or this effort to wrest his team away from him. And he certainly is not the first franchise owner in professional sports to be revealed as a rube. One of the people whose name has not been mentioned much this week is a hockey guy, Norm Green. Anybody remember the North Stars owner, Norm Green, who ended up being accused of groping all the female staff? And one of the reasons I think he took the North Stars out of Minnesota and left us without hockey here for 10 years or whatever it was because he was a perv.
But you brought hockey back, though, right? That was you, right?
Right.
Oh, that was, okay. That was
Norm. Yeah, my cousin Norm. I actually did help. I wrote a lot about it and covered the first games of the Wild here, covered the 2003 playoffs. I was in Denver in 2003 when the Wild won that game 7, and I was working for the Pioneer Press. That was, yeah, it seems like deja vu all over again.
But I thought you hate sports.
I do. I hate, you know, that is such a, how can you hate sports? I've got 5 boys and a girl who played hockey, and I still got people playing hockey and lacrosse and all the rest in my family. Sports is part of life. I love sports. I just don't like jackwads who own the sports teams, and that's a big difference.
Tom, we can say that we're on the air, right? Okay, good.
Sure, why not?
I'm not even sure what jackwad means, but it seemed to fit.
I'm going to say it means the same thing as jerk face.
Well, so just to go back to, we're talking about unmasking people's opinion, and let's go back to 1978, a little flashback here, and you didn't have a recorder, you didn't have a camera, but you were at the Lions Club, yes. just having fun.
In Waseca, Minnesota, my stepfather at the time, a really great guy, I love him dearly and still do, he's still around, he was the sheriff of Waseca County at the time, and he had gotten that job because the previous sheriff, great Irish politician named Don Eustace had been shot and killed in the line of duty. And my father-in-law, whose name was Mert Schwartz, was elevated to the sheriff's position, but was not a political type person. I came from a political family in St. Paul, so I was helping him do his campaign, trying to get the job for real. And I was over there that night when I was invited. Let's go. Forget about pounding these campaign signs up. Let's go to the Lions Club. I hear Calvin Griffith is going to be here. And so I thought, well, you know, I love the Twins. I love baseball. I went to my first Twins games when I was 11 years old, and they were here for the first time. So, I hate sports. I love the Twins. I just think that these sports teams are important to our identity and our legacy, and you have to defend sometimes against their jackwad owners.
But you're hanging out having some hot dish or having some bars, and the owner of the Twins at the time, and you're probably, I mean, you're a young guy, you're thinking this is pretty neat that here's the owner of the Twins, he's here talking.
Right, I was 28, and my father, this gets really complicated, and you may be not interested in all this. My father was the DFL majority leader in the state Senate.
Nick Coleman Sr.
Right. Actually, we have different middle names. So it was just Nick Coleman and Nick Coleman, and it was confusing for people. But I had covered the Stadium Commission, which was at that time building or beginning to the process to build a new domed stadium for the Twins. I had gone to Calvin Griffith press conferences. I had asked him questions. But unsurprisingly, he didn't really seem to have paid all that much attention. So the Lions Club, they knew who I was, because my father-in-law was the sheriff. And they knew I was a reporter for the Minneapolis paper at that time, and that they warned Cal. I mean, I know that they warned Cal. Someone told me later, look out, Nick Coleman is here. And so when he began to answer questions, and he went right off the tracks right away, the first he stopped himself and he said, wait a minute, somebody said Nick Coleman is here. Is Nick Coleman here? And I just turned totally red, and I sunk in my chair, waved my hand, said, yeah, I'm here over here, Calvin, but I just like to go to the games. I don't write about them. And he looked at me like, who the hell are you? And and then he went on. And the rest is history, because he kept putting his foot in his mouth all night after that.
Yeah, he said some remarks, the reason why he brought the Twins here, which were, in this day and age, would have probably would not have gone over well, and they didn't go over well in that era either. But it sounds like, and I read the column a while back, and this is the column was you know, from you, that Calvin Griffith might have made some remarks on non-white baseball fans, and the reason why he brought him here was, you know, more of the good, hardworking
Yes. See, first of all, someone asked. I mean, this is Waseca. We're all. It's a small city, and you know the people are good-hearted and kind, and they just wanted to be entertained by the owner of the Twins. Are all baseball fans. And the first question was, why did you bring the Twins? I mean, it was still fresh then, seemed like it. 1961, the Twins came here from D.C. after Calvin Griffith had promised he would never leave Washington, D.C. So why did you bring the team here, Calvin? So I'll tell you what. Why did I? I'll tell you why. And then he leaned forward and he said, wait a minute, are there any black people here? And he looked at, you know, and he looked around.
Well, he checked at least.
Yeah.
It's like the start of a racist joke.
Oh, my God. And I'm sitting there thinking, I just came here to put campaign signs up for my father-in-law. Please don't start talking like I'm afraid you're going to start talking. And, of course, he did. He went on and said, because he found out there were only 15,000. I don't think that was accurate, but only 15,000 black people here, just a bunch of hard-working white people. He knew it would be good for baseball because, I tell you, when these black people go to ball games, they send up such a cheer. It's like at a wrestling match, and they kind of – obviously, he wasn't all that fond of African-American people. So it went off the tracks really early. As you say, didn't have even a notebook or a tape recorder, but believe me, if you're, I think my third grader could have committed some of the things he was saying to memory, which is what I did when he started saying all these preposterous
things.
On
a napkin, you're writing
that? And writing some notes on a napkin and hoping that he would stop now anytime. So, because I was thinking, and this is old, before the internet and before cell phones and all that. So this was late. It was actually an evening event. It was 10 o'clock by the time I got out of there, and it was too late to call my bosses back at the Minneapolis paper and explain to them I had just witnessed this 8-car, accident in Waseca with Calvin Griffith. But I called them the next morning and read off the notes I had jotted down afterwards and said, what would you say if I said Calvin said this or that? And they went, holy cow. Ordered me to write a story for the Sunday paper.
You didn't run by Sid Hartman to make sure he was okay with this, before you...
Sid who?
That's right.
Oh, Sid, yeah, I remember him. Yeah, yeah. Well, when did he die? he's still there, and I'll tell you about Sid, because this is the problem. This is exactly the problem. I had never spoken to Sid Hartman before that. I was 28 years old, and he was already a million and 10. And he came up to me, found me in the hallway, and started screaming at me, why the hell did you print that stuff about Calvin? And I don't know, Mr. Hartman. I just told the editors they told me to do it. He said, well, I've heard him say those things a million times. And then I said, well, really? Because if you heard him say that a million times, you should have put it in the newspaper. And there was a tolerance at that time for, Cal is just Cal, and these stupid things he says, what do you expect? He's always saying stupid things. But I think what happens is that newspapers start venerating or protecting, which is even worse, millionaires and now billionaires. I mean, Calvin couldn't even afford to own a baseball team anymore. He was almost a subsistence baseball team owner. Today, it's the billionaires like Jack Watt Sterling, who in the L.A. Clippers, they think they run the world, and they think they're protected, and they think they can say or do anything they want to and be not held accountable. Well, Calvin at least wasn't like that, but he had been, I think, coddled by people like Sid and other reporters.
And were you frightened? I mean, again, the Twins are a beloved institution in the 1970s. They are now. You got the sports guys. Again, you're a younger guy. Were you afraid you were going to cause more damage to yourself than you were? what that journalism ethos is.
Well, I was afraid that. I didn't have any proof. I mean, I don't think they would even let me write that story today, especially at the Star Tribune. Did I say Star Tribune?
The Star what?
Whatever that paper is. Because I wasn't assigned to be there. The remarks were inflammatory. It was questionable as to whether Mr. Griffith even knew I was there, although he'd been warned I was there. There was obviously confusion in his mind. And I didn't have a contemporaneous record or a cell phone recording or anything like that. I just had my recollection and my notes. So today, by the way, that newspaper we're talking about is owned by a billionaire sports franchise owner. I'm guessing they would say, I would have called up the next morning and said, here's what Calvin said to the Waseca Lions. Should we do anything about that? And they would have said, go to hell, Coleman.
All right.
We don't do that.
It'd make a very uncomfortable moment at the Minneapolis club the next Saturday morning when the owners, you know, get together
Right, exactly. And so what I was afraid I didn't go in. I was naive and 28, and I was the Rochester Bureau, by the way. So I wasn't living in the big cities. I was living in Rochester, Minnesota, right where the Zumbro River and Bear Creek meet every 100 years. They met in my basement while I was there. And, you know, a long way from Minneapolis. So it was a weird situation, because at first I just told my editors, I said, wow, write that for the paper on Sunday. My father-in-law, I told him, look, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to talk to the bosses, and if they want me to write something, I've never heard anybody talk like this in public before. And so he said he was good with that. Just do what you got to do, kid. And I thought everything was good, and then the crap hit the fan when that story came out. My father-in-law actually called me up. He'd just come home from church. He said, holy cow, everybody is talking about this. They're really upset about this. And I got one favor to ask you. Do not set foot in Waseca County until after the election. And I didn't. And you know, thankfully, he won, but he had to stay up all night on election night counting votes to find out. He had just squeaked by, and he was elected sheriff and did honorable service. He had been standing next to the sheriff when the guy was shot and killed by a mentally ill guy, so it could have been him. But at any rate, a lot of history long ago, but I was secure at first until Calvin, oh my God. They were having, and the reaction, the Twins were playing their last game of the season in Kansas City. Herb Carneal, who was the play-by-play announcer. I'm driving up from Rochester to see my old man in St. Paul. And on the way, Herb Carneal's introducing the program, saying the Twins game's coming up, but there'll be some lineup changes today, fans. The boys are passing around the Minneapolis paper in the dugout, and they're really upset. In fact, Butch Weiniger had broken his hand on a water cooler, smashing his fist against the water cooler when he read it, because Calvin had told the Waseca Lions that Butch Weiniger, his really up-and-coming, promising young catcher, shouldn't have gotten married, taking his mind off the game. He should have just taken advantage of all the free whatever that's available on the road, and then he would have been a better ball player. Butch was like a newlywed. He took that personally, and more importantly, Rod Carew had taken his uniform off and said he wouldn't play that day, was sitting in the locker room, spitting on the floor, saying, spit on Calvin Griffith. I will not be an N-word on his plantation anymore. Now, he was convinced to put his uniform on, come back and play that day, but that was his last day in a Twins uniform. And stuff like that indicated, oh, my God, the NAACP, Twin Cities chapter boycotted, came out and said boycott the Twins. Calvin Griffith, the front page editorial in the Minneapolis Star, and this is before the Star and Tribune were merged, Minneapolis Star front page editorial demanding that he sell the team and leave town. Midwest Federal, the savings and loan, which was the broadcast partner sponsor for TV and radio games, they withdrew their contract from the team. Stuff was coming from all over the country, and this is before 24/7 cable, before internet, and everybody. I mean, today it would have been
faster, much harder.
Right.
Our guest today, Nick Coleman, talking about this, the infamous article on Calvin Griffith's comments at the Waseca Lions Club, and I read in the City Pages blog, and also again in the column that you wrote years ago, the same thing happens whether it be Mel Gibson or you take your pick of who makes these strange remarks. Insensitive remarks. I was taken out of context. You got first of all, they deny it. Then it was taken out of context. And then, well, if you know me, you know that I'm not like that.
Well, unfortunately, people who knew him knew that he was like that, apparently, from what Sid Hartman had told me. But that's when I started to get worried, because who was I? I wasn't anybody. I'm just a little reporter who was there to help his father-in-law that night. And by the way, the editor, publisher of the Waseca paper, who had invited Cal down to Waseca, came running up to me at the end of the dinner and said, "Oh, my God, Nick, what are we going to do? We made Cal think this was all off the record. Then you show up. You're going to write about this?" And I said to him what I said to the father-in-law: "I've never heard anybody talk like this. I'm going to have to tell my editors. They'll decide." "Oh, God, Nick, what are we, you know, I'll tell you what. You print it in the Minneapolis paper, and we'll reprint your story, and we'll blame it all on you." And they totally did that. They never wrote anything about it except reprinted what was in the Minneapolis paper. Yeah, there was probably 100 people, 150 maybe, but there was and they were trying to get Calvin to moderate his comments at times. I mean, they laughed. And then they kind of got.
Did he have handlers? Did he have anyone?
No.
I mean, you look at. I mean, Ziggy or Glenn Taylor. They got handlers. They got assistants. They got people around them all the time.
I know. Because at the groundbreaking for the Viking Stadium, I asked Ziggy Wolf, went right up to him and said, "Mr. Wolf, did you bother telling the state of Minnesota that you were the target of a civil criminal trial in New Jersey when you were asking?" And you know, his handlers pushed me out of the way more effectively than a Vikings front line.
Well, governor didn't know that.
No. Oh. Well, right. He didn't know a lot of things. But so Calvin came out of there insisting, and this is when I got worried, insisting, "I never said those things," is the first thing he said. Then he said, "That Coleman guy must have misinterpreted what I had to say." And then the next day he said, "Well, I was, you know, I had a couple of drinks. I'm not sure. A little drinky winky is what I said exactly." And it was like about day four before he said, "I'm sorry." And in fact, by that time, people in the Waseca Lions Club had been quoted saying that no good Coleman must have had a secret tape recorder, because we didn't know he was reporting about this. And, well, I was just, you know, I felt like I was, you know, if you watch the old Laurel and Hardy movies and the big fat guy slips on a banana peel and rubs his butt. That's how it felt. It was just like, I wish I wasn't here.
Would you be able to live with yourself? Had you gone to this and had you walked away from this, would you have been able to live with yourself as a journalist and not reported that?
It never even occurred to me that I wouldn't at least tell my – I mean, I obviously they had the authority to decide whether I wrote mm-hmm. anything. But at that time, the paper was not afraid of angering a powerful person. Cal didn't have, I mean, that's another change between then and now. He didn't have handlers. He didn't have a PR firm. He wasn't really insulated or isolated.
And it blew over. This did blow over.
Eventually, it took a long time. He was very hurt by it, and he was going around the state years later, still denying that he did it or that Coleman was drunk and the paper was in trouble, and so he did it to invent his career, and the paper did it to try to stay out of bankruptcy. Of course, they have been in bankruptcy since then, but a long time after that. And so it was very contentious. Years later, his son Clark Griffith at one point was quoted as saying, "You know, my old man is like pretty much convinced himself he was never ever in Waseca in his life." And of course, that wasn't true. But here's the funny part. Years later, he writes his autobiography with some help, and it's called, I think, Calvin, the Last Dinosaur. And he's signing copies at a bookstore in St. Paul, and I'm working at the Pioneer Press by then. I get in line. I buy the book, and then I stand there waiting for his autograph, and I haven't seen him for a long time. And I'm opening the book up to the index and looking, oh, my God, Nick Coleman, page 168 or whatever it is. And then I open that page. Just as I get up to the table, it's Calvin is saying in the book, "If I would have had a gun, I would have shot the SOB."
And for real?
And that's in the book. And then I put it down in front of him, and he looked up, and he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Don't you recognize me, Calvin?" And then he looked up and it took a second or two and, Oh, Nick, by golly, it's good to see you.
Of course it is. Hey, everyone's a tough talker until you're up close.
Jeez. Chum?
So I have that book on my shelves autographed by Calvin and a picture of him with his arm around me and big dopey grins on both of our faces.
I got to say, one thing I admire about you is you're not afraid to go up and – now, are you going to go to Garrison Keillor's next book signing? That's the next one I'm going to ask. Are you going to go to that one?
Listen, Garrison and I have now crossed each other's paths on the sidewalk without throwing anything, so I think we're good, but it was tough for a while. My mama, I grew up on West 7th in St. Paul. My mama came from Rondo. She wasn't afraid of nothing, and she washed my mouth out more than a few times, and she kind of straightened me out on things, but the one thing that she gave all of her kids, I think, is she ain't really afraid of that much. And and I really appreciate, what she taught us. And one thing she taught us was, like, if you see an accident happening or something that should be brought attention to, that's your job.
Well, I think that Sterling's have a tougher time blowing this one over than Calvin did. I don't think there'll be many statues for Sterling once this is said and done. The longest-termed tenured owners in the NBA.
I will say in Calvin's defense that, he wasn't phony. I mean, he was what you saw. He had grown up in that family, in the baseball, and in Washington, D.C., which happens to be one of the most racist towns in the country. I don't think it was, really a big mystery, especially because he was born at the age or era that he was, that he might harbor some of those attitudes. But this guy, Sterling, is 100 times worse because he is a hypocrite and pretended he was something he wasn't.
He accepted awards from NAACP.
Right.
I mean, he's masking something he's not. Calvin Griffith, you make the argument he's a product of his generation. Archie Bunker-like kind of quality. Come in, you know what you know.
Yeah.
Sterling, he'll wine and dine, as it's politically correct for him.
He'll lie under oath. I mean, he has done that. Obviously, I was watching the cable networks and about an old girlfriend that he wrote love notes to and how much he always loved her and how much money he was giving her. And then pretty soon under oath, he was suggesting that was just for sex. He didn't have any personal relationship, and it was totally lying.
I think it's great he's still married. I mean, he's still married to this woman, and he's got a new girlfriend every so often.
Well, I assume that woman has a pretty solid lock on some of his billions. it is really an interesting story because people have forgotten it. Calvin didn't blow over as in blow over. It took years. I know that Calvin and his son Clark are it's still a sore spot with them, and I don't blame them. It was, but it was kind of a furor and an uproar. And, eventually everybody just kind of moved on, and it wasn't easy. But the Twins have always, they've always, at that time anyway, had a reputation for not having many black players on the team, and they had a lot more, Latinos or Hispanics from the Caribbean, like Tony and Vic Power and all those, Zoilo back in the day when I was a kid. But they'd always dealt with a sort of a reputation as not being that friendly towards African Americans, so that just made everything worse, and I think took a long time for them to get over. But I'm glad that Calvin and Carew reconciled before Calvin passed on, and I don't have any trouble, to be honest, with Calvin's statue being outside Target Field.
No, I mean, you have to give him this. He brought the Twins here. He did create a baseball legacy in this town, and again, a product of his generation. Can give him a lot of thanks for that.
Right, and he had to sell out to the billionaires, the Polad family, and believe me, they got a lot of public relations help from people.
Let's take up a quick break. I actually wanted to ask you about another NBA owner in town here and that paper we don't talk about, but I do have some questions in your comments on this. We'll take a break on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback at Twin Cities, Tom Osmond, with my guest Nick Coleman of the Uptake, uptake.org, correct?
Yes, I'm the executive editor. It's a nonprofit online news thing, and like all nonprofits, it needs your support.
Okay, we'll go to uptake.org. Okay. They do some great work. They do some. They've had some great during the recount and during other events here in the state.
I first started paying attention when I was at the Republican National Convention 2008. My editors, who by that time already decided I was a liability, because I hate to break this, but there was a guy named Tim Pawlenty. He used to be governor of this state. He wanted me dead. You can't actually kill a guy now and throw him in the river, but he did as good as he could. And so I was allowed only to write a few inches buried inside the paper every day from the convention. But because of the uptake, I was aware of where this action was happening on the streets. And I got to appreciate the independent and nonpartisan, nonprofit, truth-telling. It's a rare thing.
So the Star Tribune is now, we think, in the final stages of a purchase by Glenn Taylor, a former Republican legislator and owner of the NBA franchise. Timberwolves. That's right. Yeah, that team.
Are they still here?
I think they're still here. I think part of them are. No, they didn't go away.
Cover that they're running the playoffs of 2004, and I think they recognized they wrecked the team when they got rid of Kevin Garnett. But
there was a guy that
they're still here.
He needed to feed his family, and then they had they lost a coach. But he bought the paper, and a couple things surprised me. Now, first of all, the price that the cow sold it for in 98 was, what, $600
million? I think it was $1 billion, as Austin Powers might say.
$1 billion, and Glenn Taylor's, I think, $100 million is about what I've seen.
Yes, $100 chump change for a guy like Glenn Taylor.
Not a bad deal. What, you know, the obvious, people are wondering, okay, now we have a conservative owner. I don't know if would you consider Glenn Taylor a, you know, one of the, you know, what do you call the decent or ordinary Republicans, or one of the extreme right wingers?
You make me laugh. ODRs, I call
ODR,
them. Ordinary,
that's right.
Decent Republicans.
I read your columns. I know what.
That's because in Northern Ireland, and I talked to the police a lot when I spent a couple of reporting trips in Ireland, they called ordinary criminals ODRs. Sees ordinary decent criminals,
right,
as opposed to the terrorists. So I think it's fun to call them the ODRs. But he's an ordinary decent Republican. I don't have any problem with his political philosophy or his beliefs in how the state should run. But I think he doesn't know much about journalism, and I don't know why a guy would spend $100 million on a newspaper, and then you come in and the first thing you say is, they suck, which is in essence what he said, that they don't cover both sides of a story. You should have got up there, Mr. Taylor, and defended your staff as people who work hard to inform you about what is happening and why, and defended their integrity. They just won two Pulitzer Prizes, and instead you just added to their reputation problem.
Well, I assume you read Britt Robinson's column in MidPost, Sit Down with Glenn Taylor, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it was, we're going to see a shift in our stories, and we're going to take different angles of the story, or as it's been called, fair and balanced. And I know that as a columnist, you went through this process before where they brought in, you know, we have to have a morality columnist, we have your column, we have all four corners covered.
Yeah, and that is a sign of a organization that has lost its compass and lost its courage, because they're always afraid what someone might say instead of actually just trying to do their job as well as they can. I think Mr. Taylor, that was a big misstep here for a new owner. And in fact, who told him that there's only two sides of a story? Hello, try journalism 101. There are any countless number of sides to a story, but only one side is worth anything, and that side is the truth, or as close as you can come to it. And so he's, he may be worth $2 billion, which he is. He's certainly no Calvin Griffith. No, he isn't, but he could have used some better media public relations advice when he bought that paper.
Right. He could use some handlers to be around him, and he'll probably want that. Well, maybe he'll have a staff of handlers now with the paper.
I am available, Mr. Taylor.
I think you two would hit it off, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure.
Maybe you can do the sport. Hey, well, if Sid retires, you can take over that column then.
Sid can't retire because the deal, the pact he signed with the devil doesn't allow retirement.
That's right. That's right. Let's talk also about the state of the paper today. He bought a $100 million paper, which was $1 billion 15 years ago. I noticed that Michael Broadcorp is a blogger now at the Star Tribune. Blogs, you at one point in your columns, there were some friction between a couple bloggers in town, and this is...
Hey, look, they... yes. Michael Broadcorp. What do we know about Michael Broadcorp?
Well...
Truth teller? Stand-up dude? Honest operator? Why are they hiring Michael Broadcorp? Because for the sensation value? I mean, I really don't understand that. There's some... You know, talk about... The bloggers are... I don't believe getting paid. If they are getting paid, it's nickels and dimes. But their material, their presence there is valuable to the paper and maybe to their brands and their careers. So I'm not blaming Broadcorp or anybody else for wanting to
market yourself
to blog there, right? But you know.
Well, Denny Hecker used to have a car show too in town too. I want to point that out. So it's you know,
right, but it is a good question. You know, what is journalism worth? Who has access? Who doesn't? And whose oxes get gored? I will point out that I think if you're a lowly paid worker or an hourly wage worker or a welfare client, heaven protect you from the hard-charging journalism in this town because your ass is in the line of fire. If you're billionaires or some Fortune 500 corporation or whatever, you don't really have to worry. You've got friends in high places. And I think that means journalism has been turned on its head here. When I was at the university and I was the editor of the Minnesota Daily back in 1971-72, you know, we had a credo, and it was the purpose of journalism is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And I said that once in recent years at the Star Tribune in the office, and people snickered because that is no longer true. And in fact, it makes you sound like some kind of Girl Scout if you believe in that, but I still do.
Well, and somehow it made money. I mean, that paper made money. Granted, there was different. There wasn't the media overload, in the we'll call it golden age of papers, or even the part of the 20th century. There is a balance between trying to compete as a dead tree publication, and as we were talking about off air, publications that are online. They're giving it away for free. They are or just scraping different pieces from around. Other paid publications. It doesn't do a lot of good for people, a lot of people in my generation to buy a paper because you can get the information you don't want for free. Unfortunately, people that are working in journalism want to get
right.
paid to do what they do.
Why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free, I think is how teenagers' mothers used to say to them. So, it's a good question. I get the papers, and I never take them out of the plastic bags. I just throw the plastic bag with the paper inside into the recycling bin because I'm going to read it online, and that part is free, most of it, although I do have electronic subscriptions when necessary, so I can see that.
And one thing I also we've talked about here before, we've had people from TV and radio on here. You've been with the paper for a long time, and you were before email. You were there when you got voicemails, you had messages. You got a lot of comments on your columns. You used to have there'd be lightning rods of comments, and I used to enjoy reading through some of those comments because people can really get unhinged writing comments on the paper.
Well, right? There's a lot of these comments. I'm gonna tell you. Can you say the word D-bag on the radio?
We'll leave it at that.
Well, I was called that on Star Tribune comments. This is like waking up in the morning, going out to get the paper, and finding there is hate graffiti has been spray painted on your door. I would work I'd write my column. I'd go home. I'd wake up and find that my family, my journalistic career and reputation are all being besmirched by people who are anonymous. I have no idea who they are. In fact, a lot of them were not who they said they were. Some people have been paid in this country to attack people on journalistic websites. And I will point out that, you know, we also had the same time I was getting those kind of comments every day. And by they called me horrible words, but our spam filter or whatever they were using didn't filter them out because they couldn't spell. If you can't spell D-bag correctly, there's nothing that the filtering software would do about it. The paper wouldn't defend me. And, you know, you still see there's many stories in the paper that they don't have comments about because they know that the haters and the mouth breathers are out there and they're going to spam it up with all these horrible, hateful comments, and they don't want to invest the time or the talent to moderate these comments. And so they just put a lot of stories that might be controversial beyond being able to comment on. But I will point out that in 2005, I was hired back, started at the Tribune in the early 70s, went to the Pioneer Press from the mid-80s until the early 2000s, went back to the Star Tribune. And at that point, the right-wingers who hated me and went crazy, all of whom were very, I would say, have short memories, because when I was at the Pioneer Press and the Democrats were in charge of the legislature and the governor's office, I was just as tough on them as I ever was on Tim Pawlenty, who was in charge by the time I got back to the Star Tribune. But that's when they started paying attention.
Yeah, I don't think Rudy Perpich and Mark Dayton there's no picture of you with arm and arm on your mantle, right?
I was afraid Perpich was going to come down and punch me in the nose when he left office. He was probably figuring he'd like to punch a lot of people. But no, I haven't been, I don't have a side. That drives me crazy. People say, well, you just supporting your side. Really, what is my side? My side, I think, is, you know, a sense of or an idea of a public interest and a public good that needs defending. One of my favorite governors was Elmer L. Anderson, who died a few years ago, but he was a Republican governor and one of the best governors and the most decent men we ever had. But he wouldn't probably even get endorsed by the Republican Party today, and that's the problem. So these people came out, they attacked the Star Tribune, they attacked me, they attacked the Minnesota Poll, they held rallies in front of the newspaper, and the paper was being taken over by people who do not know or did not know one thing about the state of Minnesota or anybody's journalism career. They totally caved. And now, if you look at it, Glenn Taylor, even though he's a moderate by many of these standards, they have direct access. The people who were attacking the Star Tribune as the Red Star 10 years ago now basically own it.
And as we wrap this up, where does this generation of reporters go? Where does your generation go from here?
My generation? Oh, you know, I'm 63, so you can see where that's going. Younger reporters, I've taught some journalism classes at the U and elsewhere, and you know what? They're smarter than I was. They're not really planning on having a career in journalism. They think it's kind of fun to do that for a few years while they're in their 20s and they don't have a wife or a home, a house payment or anything like that. But they figure that by the time they want to settle down, they'll get a decent job. And if you look at the University of Minnesota, most of the people who were like journalism majors decades ago are now what they call stratcom majors, strategic communications. They don't want to tell the truth. They want to work for a corporate enterprise and tell the corporate truth. So, I don't know. They're going online. Citizen journalism, independent journalism, nonpartisan journalism, nonprofit journalism. If I have any hope at all, that's where it goes.
Well, Nick, uptake.org, you can see Nick Coleman's work and also the state I'm in. And what's the blog website?
That one, I think it's just nickcolemanmn.com. And I haven't really done anything there lately. I'm writing some things behind the scenes. I hope I'll still be able be allowed to still live here.
Well, back here. You have a place. You have a microphone here anytime.
It's close to Wisconsin. I can just jump in and swim for it.
Nick, thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Hey, we'll be back next Saturday on Flashback Twin Cities. This is Tom Osmond here on KLAB Club 1220.